rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
After a phenomenal 4 weeks in France, it is the Tour de Four for the USA. Champions of the world once again. It's been a tournament that could be a game changer for the women's game. But for now, it's the same old name on the World Cup trophy. Hello and welcome to the Game World Cup podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer. Yes, the USA retain the World Cup after a 2-0 victory over the Netherlands in Lyon on Sunday. A fourth title for America after a summer where records were smashed both by those on the pitch and those watching at home. Here to look back on it all, we're joined by former England star Claire Rafferty. Down the line from France, from the Sunday Times, we also have Rebecca Myers, plus women's football reporter for The Times, it's Molly Hudson. Later on, we'll be picking out our own highlights and lowlights from the tournament. But we start with a record fourth World Cup victory for the USA. Second-half goals from Megan Rapinoe and Rose Lavelle saw off a brave resistance from the Netherlands as America ran out 2-0 winners. The deadlock was broken on the hour when the US were awarded a penalty after a high boot from Stephanie van der Graaf on Alex Morgan. Claire, any complaints about that decision?
For me, none at all. Live, I thought it was a penalty. And then even on the replays, I know what, I think there was a bit of a reaction on Twitter that suggested otherwise. But I think de Graaf, it was clumsy. She, her leg was high in the air and she ended up catching her. And, you know, we've seen them give them time and time again in this tournament. And, yeah, penalty, it was a bit frustrating because neither team was really getting a grip of the game, were they? And that almost gave the edge to USA. And from then, Holland couldn't really recover.
Morgan has been accused of going down easily in this tournament, Rebecca.
I have to say, I very much, you know, I have said and I would stand by, the US team are still pretty much the only women's players that we see, like, really diving. And Rapinoe as well. I mean, Morgan, I think, is probably the worst culprit for it. And I remember certainly in some earlier games, you know, the kind of USA-Spain one particularly brings to mind, there were moments when you just saw, like, replays that you just looked at and thought, oh, come on. But Rapinoe, I love Rapinoe, and I think she's quite guilty of it as well. She certainly stays down quite easily, should we say. There's a lot of sort of diva kind of, oh, God, I'm on the floor and everything hurts so well when she goes down. And it's something you don't really see a lot in women's football, so I think that's maybe why it stands out quite so much.
The USA had struck early in every match at this tournament, but the Dutch kept them at bay. It was goalless at half-time. Molly, what was their game plan and how was it working?
I think what they did very well was they sort of sat back without sitting back too much. I think you can fall into that trap really easily where you just sit back and defend and you've got nowhere to go forward. And I think what they did so well was that they had Tobiasen, they had Miedema, they had that outlook to go forward. So at times they were able to counter-attack and they did have the solid two banks of four, but at the same time they did offer a threat going forward as well, which meant that the US couldn't sit back and they couldn't really go out and attack. So I think it really could have gone either way.
Well, Rapinoe was that stepped up for that penalty, becoming the oldest goal scorer in a Women's World Cup final. It was fitting for her to have her say on the final day. Claire, for you, is she the star of the tournament?
Yeah, what a woman. She's really has embraced the platform and the stage she's been given, and it almost did become a bit of a stage, didn't it? Because it was a bit of pantomime. Obviously, she had the debate with Donald Trump, who then told her to, you know, stop talking until she actually wins, and then to be able to step up and score a penalty under not just the pressure of your whole nation, but the whole world now is watching you because of that, because it's been very visible. And to be able to do that and have such mental strength, I mean, hats off to her. She really stands up for equal rights, LGBT. She's very outspoken. And yeah, player of the tournament for me. What a way to end. What does she get? Golden boot, golden everything,
golden ball, golden boot. She did win everything.
Fantastic player.
Rebecca, how do you sum up her impact on the women's game?
I mean, I think her impact has been actually immeasurable this World Cup, because she's become that sort of cult figure, that icon of the game that I think women's football doesn't always have. I mean, people who literally probably wouldn't have engaged in the World Cup at all have been, you know, captured, you know, their imaginations. Megan Rapinoe's sort of captured their hearts in a way. I saw so many sort of women on Twitter who maybe don't necessarily watch the games themselves coming on board with her views and her stance and her activism. And I think she's become that sort of global icon figure that just drives the image and the popularity of the women's game through the roof. She was on the front page of the Times today, and I just think it's this glorious photograph. I'm tempted to sort of frame it, to be honest. I just think it's hard to find a footballer in any tournament, male or female, who becomes enough of a personality to go on the front page of the papers that aren't from the country they're born in, if that makes sense. You know, she's not British, and she's on every single front page this morning. I just think we probably won't be able to register quite how much of an impact she's had until we all kind of, you know, go home, have some space and think about this tournament.
Yeah, that is an iconic image of Rapinoe that you're referring to there. It may be her last World Cup. The second goal came from Rose Lavelle, and she certainly looks like someone with a bright future, Claire.
Yeah, what an elegant player as well. Her balance, her ability to drop a shoulder and beat someone. That goal was fantastic. Yeah. Such a young player, and to be that bold and fearless, to pick the ball up the way she did and drive forward and then have the calm, cool head to slot it away against the goalkeeper, who was absolutely fantastic. I mean, you could see there was a few examples of her inexperience where she'd lose the ball in areas that she probably shouldn't do. But what a team she has around her to learn from. And this is the next generation of American players coming through. We have the likes of Rapinoe, Morgan leading, but then we have these youngsters coming through who arguably we'd love to be in that same position in England. Yes, we do have the potential, don't we, with the likes of Georgia Stanway, but we need our big players now to step up, just like the Americans are.
Molly, a word for Jill Ellis, the first manager to win the Women's World Cup twice.
She's such a cool, calming influence where, you know, a lot of the players have taken the headlines and they've discussed such a lot of things and made political statements and equality. And Jill sort of does all that, but she does it in a way that doesn't take the headlines. She says it in a calm way, and she's changing the game for women just by doing what she does. And I think, you know, her being not only the first coach, but the first women's coach to win two in a row is just an incredible achievement. And I think it's made all the more incredible because, you know, she had to move away from England just to play football, let alone coach it. And I think, you know, she must be so proud that she made that big decision growing up, because that, you know, that's made her into the coach and the amazing coach that she is now.
The US remained the benchmark in women's football, but they were tested in this tournament. Claire, do you think that the gap is perhaps shortening between the US and the rest of the world?
Yeah, Jill Ellis said that this is the toughest World Cup so far, and that's because, you know, all these teams are evolving and growing. The level of professionalism in European teams, in particular, the likes of Italy and England, France, you know, the contact hours, we say it time and time again, is USA have almost been pro because of their college programs, that their exposure to football or soccer, whatever you want to call it, is 10 times more than some of our youngsters. But that's changing now. And also, let's not bypass the fact that USA had to beat Sweden, Spain, France and England to get to this final. So they really did deserve it in the end. They beat some world-class teams, and it's them pushing the barriers and the boundaries as well, constantly evolving. I know I use that word quite a lot, but you have to be like the new version of you all the time, because the rest are chomping at the heels.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I think Rose Lavelle just 4 years ago was working in a pizza shop. So, you know, there are stories, background stories to all of these players. They haven't necessarily all come through the system in the way that we might expect them to. They still have had to work hard to get to the level that they're at right now. And there were chants of equal pay echoing around the stadium after the final whistle. Rebecca, explain to us what that's all about for anyone that isn't quite aware of what's going on.
Yeah, so the US have actually got an ongoing lawsuit against their own federation, the women's team. Basically, I mean, the men are paid substantially more than the women. They're significantly less successful. I mean, you know, in very kind of stark quantitative ways, they are less successful. The women have four World Cups and four Olympic golds now. And even down to the coaching staff, Jill Ellis found out that she was paid less than, I think it was, the men's under 21 coach. So they've got like a lot of kind of numerical points to kind of bring up. And then they basically have taken their federation to court. So as I understand it, that case will be heard in court when they get back. So that's quite something to return to. You've won the World Cup and you have to come back and sue your own federation. But they're basically suing them for purposeful gender discrimination. And I mean, there's been a lot of this tournament. Obviously, we can go on and about, you know, well, they were the favourites and they won, etc. But I think we can't necessarily quantify what this means for that lawsuit, and what this means for their chance at getting, you know, proper compensation and proper pay going forward. And if they achieve that, that will have a trickle-down effect across the world, in my opinion. I think if you set a precedent like that, even if it's in different legal systems, if you set a precedent like that across the pond, it gives other, you know, other football teams, other federations a lot more to think about in terms of how much they're paying their women. Mm. That is ongoing. I'd also like, just to add to Claire's point, there was a very good piece this morning that said FIFA estimates basically that 13.4 million girls and women around the world play football. 9.5 million of that 13 million are in the USA alone. So I think we can't underestimate just the size of that pool. And what it, you know, obviously if you've got a pool that big to choose from, your team is just going to be head and shoulders above the rest. So yeah, just a great point from Claire. Just wanted to add that into that, a bit of food for thought, really.
Yeah, goodness me, that is a staggering amount. One last word, and we should speak about the Netherlands. There weren't many before the tournament predicting a World Cup final appearance for the Dutch, were they? Are they a new European superpower, would you say, Molly?
Definitely. I think what they've actually done is probably overtaken some of your traditional European superpowers. I mean, we look close to home and you look at England and you think, you know, what Holland have done in those 2 years since the Euros. They've developed, and not only did they win the Euros, but they weren't complacent and they really built on that. And, you know, they got to a World Cup final, which is a massive achievement. And once again, you know, losing to the defending champions is nothing to, you know, be sniffed at. And I think, you know, Germany are perhaps at a rebuilding stage and haven't quite been the superpower they once was. And, you know, you have your Sweden, your Norway, those countries that have always been there or thereabouts. But I think Holland are probably overtaking all of those. And I think they, you know, they'll be massively excited going forward. It's their first ever Olympic qualification, which is another huge milestone. And I think they'll just be really excited. They've got such a big range of talent there. I think Serena was saying last night that the average age of the squad is still under 26 or something like that, which is scary, really, that, you know, they've achieved all of this. You look at Vivian Miedema, who's just 22, and she's, you know, already all-time record goal scorer. So I think the potential is there for them to go on and be even better than they've already shown.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
It's time now to look back at a memorable month in France. 11.7 million TV viewers in the UK watch England's semi-final defeat to the USA, perhaps the peak of engagement in women's football in the modern era. But Phil Neville's side did suffer defeat to Sweden in the third place playoff on Saturday. The Lionesses finished fourth. Rebecca, is that a failure?
No, I don't think it is. I've thought about it a lot. And I think Phil's been using the word failure all the time. He's been using it constantly. Pretty much every press conference we've done since the semi-final loss, he's been saying it's a failure. I respect that he feels it's important to use that word, but I actually think it's the wrong word. And I think it hit home for me last night when we won, when Lucy Bronze won the, get this in the right way around, the silver ball and Ellen White won the bronze boot. I thought, how can you say that this is a failure when you've got two of your players have made it into the top six players in the world? I think there are questions to be asked about you know, what went wrong towards the end. Particularly, I think the third place playoff game was not a game we should be massively proud of. Something went wrong there, whether it's mentality, mindset, pure physicality, it's hard to say. But I think to come away from this and say this is a failure when they've won that many hearts and minds, they've broken that many records, and they've also won literal world-class awards, I think is probably wrong. I'm not an elite performance coach. Phil Neville knows the right way to talk to his players, but for me, it's not a failure, no.
It's interesting what you mentioned there about towards the end of the tournament, it didn't go to plan for England. Where did it all go wrong, Molly?
Sure, I would have to slightly disagree with Rebecca and just say I don't think it was fully right to start with. I think if you look across all the games, the same flaws were there. They were just exposed more against the US and Sweden because they were genuine world-class opposition. I think, you know, that there have been things that haven't gone right, not just in this World Cup, but since Phil Neville has taken over, and a lot of that stems from, you know, who plays and where they play, and getting the very best out of his best players. And I'm not sure, you know, we saw maybe the right formation or the right tactics that did that. And I think, you know, you have to come back to that US game. And as we've just mentioned, the participation and everything, it was stacked against England from the very start. And there is an argument there that regardless of what 11 players we put out there, it was never going to be good enough. The US are just too good. But I think ultimately, you can't play 4-4-2 against the best midfield three in the world. And I think, you know, that you have to look at that. And I'm sure Phil Neville and his coaching staff will be looking at that and trying to work out the best balance. I know for this tournament, we were without Jordan Knobs, which is a massive, massive miss. And I still think that was probably, you know, underestimated just how big a miss that was going to be. But I think, you know, parts of it haven't been good enough. And I think parts of it have been very good. Lucy Bronze, as we say, Ellen White, individually have been incredible, but without those two, you know, where would we have been? I'm not so sure.
This might be a difficult question for you, Claire. Bear in mind, you played in Canada 4 years ago, but how do you rank this current England team against your England team of 2015?
No disrespect to myself or any of the players who played in that, but these players are all better, even the ones that played last time around, because the exposure to the different level of professionalism. All these players are full-time athletes now. So they should be better. The ones that came before and the ones that are coming through. So I'd say this team is a lot better, and the pressure is on because we expected more from them. And it's a natural progression. And I think Molly's spot on there when she's talking about the faults were there to see really early on in the friendlies, the defensive frailties, they were quite obvious. And England ended up getting exposed. I think they have to almost go back to the drawing board and tactically revalue and get the best out of the players. Exactly what Molly hit the nail on the head. They need to be getting the best out of our world-class players because we do have world-class players.
As you say, go back to the drawing board. But he also, Phil Neville, he's been sort of controversial towards the end of this tournament. He put pressure, first of all, on himself and on the England team by saying they would win the World Cup. Then he obviously suggested it would be a failure if they didn't win the World Cup, and that they didn't win the third place playoff, it might be a failure as well. And then he referred to that third place playoff as nonsense. I'm sure you didn't agree with any of that, Claire, especially the nonsense part with third place playoff.
It's clearly an emotional reaction. He's contradicted himself, yes, because he said how important, you know, finishing as close to first as possible. But third place for me and everyone in that team is one of the proudest moments of my whole career. So for someone to devalue that, it did kind of hit a nerve a little bit, but I think Phil Neville's been great in the press. We've said it time and time again. Yes, he has been outspoken about their desire to win and the fact that they think they can. And I think he's had to do that, actually, because we need to start talking about the potential that we have and turning it into reality. And unfortunately, we did miss out. But the Americans do it. It's that winning mentality. They talk a lot about winning. And England, you know, they do need to do that as well. I think it's an important transition. So I wouldn't never fault him for that. But obviously the nonsense comment, I think, he said that they went there to win gold, but so did we last time. So I think it's just a bit of a flippant comment, and I'll forgive him.
Yeah, you'll forgive him. You'll happily show him your bronze medal if he wants to see it next time after winning that third place playoff in 2015. Just a final word on Phil Neville, Rebecca. Is he still the man to be leading England going forward?
Yeah, I do think so. I think he has been very impressive, like Claire said, in the media. I think, as Molly touched on, there are tactical things that obviously need looking at, particularly that really odd change of formation for the US. I think that was a tactical error. But I think in terms of man management, he has been superb. I've been so impressed. I think, you know, members of the public have been impressed. I heard yesterday someone was telling me that the US team were really impressed. A US journalist I was chatting to in the media centre was saying that the US players absolutely love him. They think he's brilliant, which is really interesting in itself because obviously their standard is so high. But I think what they see in him is someone who is hungry to win. And obviously they have that in spades. That's why they're champions this morning. But they obviously look at him and see some kind of similar character traits, as it were. So I think in that sense, we should be hanging on to him. But I think he cares enough. And I think he will take this to heart. I think he will go back and he will ask himself hard questions. And he will look at this, as you said he will, as a failure, but also as a failure himself. So I think he could do brilliantly at the Olympics if he sorts out these problems.
And Karen Carney, of course, announced her retirement prior to that game on Saturday. She ends her England career on 144 caps. Only Farrah Williams has won more. Claire, if you can, try and sum up Karen's significance to women's football in this country.
Ugh, where do I start? incredibly driven individual, very mentally strong, fiercely competitive, but at the same time, very, very humble, down to earth, a realist. I think the impact she has had is just immeasurable. She's seen the game transition and transforming into full-time sport. And I think it's a shame. It was sad to kind of see her go and know she was very emotional, and then obviously not being able to succeed in that last game and get the bronze medal was quite hard for her to swallow. But, you know, it's an end of an era, and I actually spoke to her yesterday and it was a bit of an emotional rally call, and it was only a conversation between us two, and she was just saying how, you know, this World Cup actually, the experienced players have been the one everyone's been leaning on. So it's time for these young ones to stand up and be counted for.
Molly, we've got to talk about the WSL, and you've written in the Times this morning about it being in turmoil. It all sounds very worrying. What is the situation?
To be honest, I think it is worrying. And I think from what I understand from speaking to various people in and around the WSL is that the FA have been running this league for a long time now, and you know, they're not sure what more they can do to push it forward. Not saying I agree with this, but if you look at the FA and what they do for men's football, they're focused on the men's team, and the Premier League runs the domestic competition. And what is very difficult is that there are flaws in the league still, and the flaws that mean there are very little sponsorships. You know, Gilly Flaherty, the West Ham captain, you know, tweeted that she didn't have a boot sponsor. And we're in such an infancy of this professional league that would prevent the Premier League from taking it on. And from what I understand, you know, they're going through a transitional process as well. Richard Scudamore has left there, and I think it's unlikely that anything will move forward until his permanent successor is found. But, you know, it feels, from what I'm hearing, that it will be in 3 to 5 years' time, which, you know, for me, when I found that out, I was just sort of really disappointed, because this is a World Cup that has broken millions of viewing figures. It's Tokyo 2020, you know, the chance to have Team GB again, and we know how amazing that was, you know, last time round. And then once again, you've got a home Euros, which is potentially the biggest ever. And I think that really could push the women's game into the mainstream. And, you know, we could genuinely win both of those tournaments. And you're saying that actually in 3 to 5 years' time, we could be in the same limbo where you have an organisation that doesn't want to run a league and nobody else is willing to take it on. And, you know, for me, that's the biggest thing from this World Cup. There has to be a legacy. These players that we've watched on the biggest stage, you know, the incredible, you know, things that they've done over this month, that has to be replicated, and it has to be, you know, understood on a day-to-day basis. These players have mortgages to pay, they have things to pay, and we have to respect them and their achievements. And it's about time that, you know, being a professional footballer is, you know, it's a proper career, and it's something that young girls can aspire to be, and they don't have to choose between, you know, a good job or being a professional footballer. And unfortunately, with the way the league is at the moment, that isn't always the case. And I think going forward, that has to change. And I don't know where that comes from, if it comes from the FA or it comes from the Premier League or, you know, somebody completely new. It just has to change, because we have to do better for these lionesses that have inspired millions.
Absolutely. And it is, having read your article, Molly, it is a very, in some ways, depressing read because, as you say, the FA have said that they can't, they're not able to take the game forward. But as you say, 3 to 5 years for the Premier League to perhaps take the WSL on will lose momentum from this World Cup, Claire. That's not what we want to be hearing when, as Molly said, we want a legacy.
Well, if that happens, then we're just going to be in the same situation next World Cup and we're going to miss capitalising on the Olympics, which is fantastic last time around in London 2012. That was a real game changer. But if we can't utilise this, as you say, momentum, then it almost feels like, what's the point?
Yeah, it's certainly not something we want to be hearing. But let's reflect on this World Cup once again and then perhaps be in a lighter mood. Let's ask all of you for your favourites, should we say. Let's start with your favourite player. Rebecca, who stood out for you?
I love Ellen White. I do. I know it's an obvious choice, but I just think we've seen her completely blossom. And I think also, obviously, there's an element of complete heartbreak in terms of having those two goals disallowed at such crucial points. But she's just been pure class. Like, she's been class to work with, to interview, to cover, to watch on the pitch. I think she's just been head and shoulders above the rest. But also, I've absolutely loved Rose Lavelle. I remember I saw her in the USA Spain game. That was the first USA game I watched. And I just sat there and thought, who on earth is this girl? Mm-hmm. Like, she's just so electric on the pitch. And I think it was Rachel Brown-Finner said during the England game that she just basically had a field day with England, you know, with the England set up, because she was like, how can I tear this pitch to shreds? But I just think she's been a joy to watch, and she's a really like sparky player who I would just love to get and see more of.
Molly, who do you think was the best player that we've seen?
Well, funnily enough, I've literally just written this piece and it is Rose Lavelle. I think, you know, in a team full of superstars, in a team full of Carly Lloyds, Alex Morgans and Megan Rapinoe, you know, they're ageing. They're coming to the end of their incredible careers that have paved the way for these young stars. And Lavelle is just that. She is the next young star. She's 24. She's, you know, as we mentioned earlier, she watched the last tournament in a pizza shop. And here she is scoring the second goal in a World Cup final, an incredible goal. And for me, the moment that made me think, wow, this player is amazing, was 4 minutes into the England game. She just megged really bright, like she wasn't there. And that takes confidence, it takes incredible ability, and it takes talent to translate all of that ability that she so clearly has and translate it onto the very biggest stage amongst all of those strong characters and the eyes of the world. And I think she is the one that, going forward, you'll think, you know, the 2019 World Cup, that was where Rose Lavelle emerged on the global stage.
Rose Lavelle getting a lot of appreciation. Claire, who's your favourite player?
Well, I can't say Rose Lavelle again, can I?
So, well, I mean, if you really want to.
I mean, Ellen White for me was outstanding. But I've really been impressed with Sofia Jakobsen. She's really grown over these last couple of years. She's very pacey. Her speed is electric. But she's also been able to improve her end product. Finishes, crossing into the box, you know, running on the back shoulder, keeping her width. She's just become this really intelligent player who knows how to play to her strengths. And against England, I think she's shone.
OK, now, we all wanted the Lionesses to do well, so I'm assuming that is all of our favourite team at this World Cup. So other than England, who would you say has been your standout nation over this last month? I'll start with Molly.
Sure, I think it's been really difficult because you looked at all the teams going into this and it was quite an open field. And I think, you know, each team sort of impressed in their very own way. I think as much as I've sort of sat back and I've watched the US and at times I've been really frustrated with the diving and the, you know, everything that comes with the US, I think actually you have to respect that. You have to sit there and go, they've just defended their title. They're an incredible side. They've had literally the eyes of the world on them. They've had more than just on the pitch matches to contend with, but they've just plowed through. And I think, you know, I wrote in my report last night that everyone thought this would be the end of an era, that the US would finally be overtaken by Europe, particularly Europe, whether it be France or England or, you know, even Spain. They really struggled in that game. But they found a way. They found a way to be better. And when that Megan Rapinoe penalty went in yesterday, it was like the floodgates opened. And suddenly you were looking at this team that were head and shoulders and, you know, anything else above everyone else. And yes, they probably came into this as slight favourites, but they come out of it as the team to beat, as a team that have done so much for the women's game. And, you know, whether you love them, I hate them, I think I personally have grown so much respect for them through this tournament.
Claire, who's your favourite team?
I really enjoyed watching Italy. They started the tournament with a bang, beating Australia against the odds. They were the dark horses. You know, they were brave. They were tactically astute. In the end, they did run out of legs against Holland and they played into their arms a little bit, conceding a lot of set pieces. But they're obviously in a massive moment for Italian football. The investment's increasing. They're attracting a lot more foreign players. And I'm really excited to watch them grow as a nation. And I hope that they can qualify for the Euros and we'll see them shine there.
And Rebecca, which nation gets your nod?
I think, just to shake it up, so we have three different ones, I'd say the Netherlands. I just think, I mean, honestly, partly mostly just because of their fans. I just think they've been such a joy to watch. We don't see that kind of really serious, proper mass fandom as much in the women's game yet. And the Netherlands have just brought enthusiasm in absolute spades. And that, you know, I think because they were up against the US and because they were, because they were sort of the other side of the draw, as it were, and therefore their matches weren't as watched as the American side of the draw. We've maybe not given them enough credit for quite how far they've risen, how fast. It really is extraordinary. I mean, if England had risen like that and done what they've done, we'd never hear the end of it. So I think they're going to be ones to watch. Like Molly said, they're super young. They've got Lillian Medema, who's just a superstar. So I think for me, yeah, they've been absolutely great to see. And any team that can hold the USA to 0-0 and go out at half-time with that, you've got to respect that.
There have been some cracking goals. Which one has been the best? Claire?
Obviously, the World Cup final goal of Rose Lavelle was fantastic. But for me, I really enjoyed Lucy Bronze's strike against Norway, mainly because it was just like deja vu sitting there watching it against Norway, exactly same situation, exactly same type of goal as last time. And there's a lot of pressure on someone who's been called a world-class player to rise to the occasion. And I think in Lucy scoring that goal in such a fantastic fashion really solidified her platform on the stage in the world-class level. So, yeah, that for me was the outstanding goal.
Rebecca, what about your favourite goal?
Yeah, I mean, I did put in Sunday's paper that Lucy's was mine, so I'll also say that. But I did love I love Fran Kirby's. I mean, I know we lost the match and so it's overshadowed by that, but I think Fran has had a tricky tournament and she hasn't sort of blossomed and come into her own and looked like a relaxed player. And then she just did this brilliant goal that just looked like, it looked like a Fran Kirby goal. It looked like a goal that she would have done, you know, a couple of years ago in the league and stuff. It was really a sort of signature goal from her and that made me really happy to see.
And Molly, which goal stands out for you?
I think for pure technique, you know, I can't argue with Claire and Rebecca and see past that Lucy Bronze goal. But for me, for the moment of what it could have meant, you know, it went on to mean nothing. But it was the Ella White equaliser against the US. And it was, you know, we were utterly outplayed. And there pops up Ellen, scores. And, you know, for that split second, you thought, could you do it? And for me, that's something that I'll always remember.
I'm just going to add another one in. It's a slightly controversial one because obviously we know what happened with Cameroon when they took on England in the knockout stage. But if you remember the group stage and their final game, Cameroon against New Zealand, Ajara and Shute secure Cameroon's place in the last 16 with a superb goal. She cut past two defenders and then sort of curled the ball into the net. There was so much pressure on it as well because it was an injury time winner. They had to win to pretty much secure their place in the last 16. So that one sort of stands out for me as well. But there have been some tremendous goals. We've been very fortunate with that. What do you think has made this World Cup, France 2019, unique, Rebecca?
Actually, one of the things I did want to touch on, and when you talk about kind of best goals, is actually how good, you know, how some of the best saves essentially have been. And one thing I think has really stood out from this tournament, which I think does set it apart from previous tournaments, is the level of kind of interest and hype and exposure around the goalkeepers. There's been loads and loads of kind of love for the goalkeepers, which is hard enough to get in any tournament, you know, men's tournaments as well. But I think female goalkeepers have historically so, you know, been that kind of easy,
scapegoat, been the easy sort of, oh, well, women can't save, or, you know, whatever the arguments are. And they've just thrived at this World Cup. I think, I mean, I love Benita Correa. I still think that was, watching her save, even though it was against England, was one of my favourite moments of the World Cup. So I think for me, there's been things like that that have stood out, and feed into this general thing of actually people just talking about it as football. I didn't think we'd see that necessarily. I didn't think we'd see that this soon. And we have. We've seen people just talking about whether or not the VAR decision was right, or just talking about how good a save it was, or just talking about the Cameroonian behaviour, rather than constantly contextualising it as women's. And that feels very, very new and very exciting.
Yeah, you're quite right about the goalkeepers, and obviously Van Veenendaal in that final was just tremendous, particularly in the first half against the USA. Claire, what will you take away from this tournament?
For me, it's been the media circus that surrounded it, which is what we've been crying out for years and years and years. The increased platform, the audiences, the fact that, you know, people are going to Battersea Park and watching the game. There's a whole vibe and buzz around it, and that's all we've wanted. You know, we've been fighting for it for years and years and years, and for people to be filling back pages with stories about women's football, for Megan Rapinoe to be on the front of the Times newspaper, that's incredible. And I just hope we can continue like this.
Mm. And Molly, what will you remember from France 2019?
I think there's two that will stick with me. I think the first is, you know, myself and Rebecca were actually lucky enough to go to France, USA, and to actually be in that stadium and see how much it meant and feel how much it meant. It was just the most incredible thing to be a part of. And to see that, you know, this wasn't women's football. It was just football, and every single person in that ground is desperate for their team to win. And, you know, you don't always get that. There's a bit of, you know, we're proud of you whether you won or lost. No, the you know, both of those sides were desperate to win. And I think that's so important for the game. And I also think that the other moment for me was probably the fact that before that US-England game, I was sat on the floor of a press conference room, and there were just press everywhere. There was cameras, there was written press, the BBC, Sky, everybody you could think of. And I just remember sitting there and thinking, wow, this many people care. And like Claire said, I think that's part of the legacy of this tournament, that yes, of course, you're not going to get that every game, you're not going to get it in the Super League, but actually for that moment, it was like every single person cared and everyone was there and living it and breathing it. And that was another thing that was so incredible to be part of as a journalist.
Yeah, it's been another tournament that has brought positivity and us all together. I think that's fair to say. And without doubt, women's football has won over new fans. It's been an absolute pleasure. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, Claire Rafferty, Rebecca Myers and Molly Hudson. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information. And we'll be back for the new Premier League season in August. We'll see you then.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.